It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfort. Today we're exploring the legendary intelligence of working dogs. In Alaska, dogs can be team members with mushers and also with hunters, using their abilities to extend our own abilities. For mushers, their endurance and hardiness are key, and also their talent to lead and follow. For hunters, well-trained dogs extend human senses to find game, create opportunities to shoot, and bring back birds that would otherwise be lost. But first, someone has to let the animals know how to do those jobs. And the jobs aren't simple. And judging by the dogs I see around Anchorage, many of us are not very good at training. But my guests today are. They work with upland hunting dogs and sled dogs to create effective team members. And it's not only about Alaska. My mushing guest in the second half got his start in Paris. The art of training hunting dogs also comes originally from the old world. Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer focuses on training hunting dogs and sled dogs. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Today we are talking about training dogs. And, you know, dogs are so intelligent. They can do such an amazing range of skills and tasks and be our partners if we know how to train them and get them to where they have those abilities. And in hunting, there's these tasks and skills are really finely tuned, and they allow us to use the amazing senses that dogs have and the abilities they have to extend our abilities. And so for this segment, we're going to be talking about training hunting dogs, specifically for upland bird hunting. And I've got a couple of guests in the studio who know quite a bit about this and do this activity and can sort of explain it to us. Bud Rice trains pointers, and he's with the Arctic Dog Association and the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association. And Gretchen Clark works with flushing dogs. She tells me she's a little bit of a newbie. She's only been at it a few years, unlike Bud. So I want to learn sort of the joy of working with dogs, and also how you get dogs up to the ability to be actually good workers out in the field when you're hunting. Bud, it sounds like you've been at this for quite a while.
Yeah. We actually got into German Shorthair pointers through ski touring. And we got dogs from Norway, and they were high-end ski touring dogs. Turned out this German Shorthair pointer that my wife got out of Oslo was a good bird dog and showed a lot of natural instinct. And so she started training that bird dog, and this is over 20 years ago. So we've been into German Shorthair pointers ever since, but we got into it through ski touring and mushing.
Yeah. And so these are very intelligent dogs, right?
Intelligent and very athletic. I think one of the key elements in selecting a dog and getting into this sport is to make sure you got a dog that has good natural instincts. So selecting mm-hmm. a pup can be an important process, and you can get good advice from members of various clubs in the state. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's three basic kind of hunting dogs in the state. There's retrievers. You've had another
We talked about that in the past.
And we have the flushing dogs that Gretchen works with and the pointing dogs that I work with. And so depending on what kind of activity you want to be involved in, you want to make sure you get good genetics and get a good dog.
Well, let's talk about what a pointer does and how when you're in the field, sort of how you work with the pointer.
Okay, so once you get a trained pointing dog, mm-hmm. That dog can range out either short distances or way out. If you're in open fields like grasslands, they can go way out several hundred yards. A lot of times we'll put bells on a dog or a GPS collar so you can track them nowadays. Mm-hmm. GPS collars are very handy. Or if you're working in dense woods, working for rough grouse or woodcock or something like that, the dog needs to work in closer. And they sort of know that instinctively. So getting the distance. Anyway, the pointing dog will go around and use its nose and smell a bird and then lock up on point. And that's kind of a standard predator thing. If you watch any wild animals like coyotes and wolves or fox, they'll freeze when they locate the prey and try to locate it with their ear and nose and then pounce. Mm-hmm. We do the same thing with our dogs. We just don't want them to do the pounce.
Right.
They wait. And we train them, you know, to stop, some sort of command for a stop. And they freeze when they locate birds and they're close. And then the hunters will find the dog and move up and then flush the bird.
Then you're going to do the pouncing. You're going to stalk up behind the dog.
And mm-hmm. a lot of times you'll caution the dog to, take mm-hmm. it easy. And then you'll walk around the dogs and flush a bird and then try to shoot it. And we don't get all of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hunting. There's no guarantee.
Right. And so really what's happening here is the dogs, senses, which are far beyond our senses, are being used to extend your ability to find the game.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I just ran into a fellow yesterday who didn't have a dog, and we had a dog, and he was not going to have as much success as we do. So
yeah.
The dogs really do extend your capabilities.
So in terms of this upland bird hunting, and the other technique would be using a flushing dog, and that's what you do, Gretchen. Tell us what a flushing dog does.
So a flushing dog works the field in front of you. So when you send them out, they are going back and forth across the field trying to use their senses to find the birds as well. And when they find the bird, you can tell when they've smelled a bird.
Uh-huh.
They get really excited, and they're very direct in what they're doing, trying to find the bird itself, and then they flush the bird out. So as opposed to pointing and stopping, you have to be aware of what your dog is doing so that you can respond really quickly when the bird gets flushed, so that you can actually shoot the bird.
Right, and this is why you go out and work with at the range shooting skeet and targets, right?
So
that you
Absolutely.
Can make that quick
right
that quick pull. So Gretchen, you were mentioning that you're kind of new to this skill. And have you been training your own dogs to become flushing dogs?
I have. I actually, so I decided to get a dog because I went hunting with my dad and I was the retriever. And I decided that wasn't as much fun. So I started looking for a dog, and I knew that I wanted an English Springer Spaniel. My dad had labs growing up, so we were part of retrieving. He used them for waterfowl.
Mm-hmm.
So I found the dog, and when I found the breeder, it took a little bit. You can't just go and look on Craigslist or something and find a dog. You have to do your research and make sure you're getting a quality dog who's
right.
got the history or...
It's because the breeding is very, very important.
It is. Mm-hmm. It can have impacts on how the dog responds to things.
Mm-hmm.
So when I found the breeder out of Delta Junction, which is Jeff Lipscomb, one of the things that he told me when I was talking to him about getting a dog was that I was going to be a part of the family, and he introduced me to the Arctic Bird Dog Association and talked to me about that and invited me to the Family Day event, which was my first event going out there with my brand new puppy that I think I picked up maybe a week before.
Uh-huh.
And I got to meet a whole bunch of people.
So you suddenly realized you're part
of
a community. Yeah. Well,
yes.
That's really valuable. And but it sounds like you've been involved in that club for a long time.
Yeah, I'm one of the board of directors right now. We've been involved for a couple of decades. And it's been a fun group.
So this is really how you're not going to learn it from a radio interview, but there are people out there who can teach you and guide you through this process.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We highly recommend that. And we have beginner classes for flushing dogs and for pointing dogs, and some really good trainers that help you get started. So I really recommend that for people.
Well, as they always say, that it's not the dog, it's the dog owner, right?
That's right.
That's where dog behavior comes from.
Absolutely. I would say I probably needed more training than the dog did at first.
Uh-huh.
But there was a lot of support, and everyone's really willing to help and guide you in the right direction.
Right, and I want to really get in-depth into the training, but you've both raised the issue of getting the right dog and starting with the right dog. And so much of this is built into the dog's instinct or the dog's breeding, which always I find amazing. You know, you want to think about, like, how much of what we do is built into our genes, right?
Oh.
But with these dogs, I mean, it's the genetically, they have come down to us through centuries as having these behaviors. So if you have a pointer, even if you've never trained it to be a pointer, it'll still point, right, Bud?
Right. Yeah, actually, case in point is the latest pointer that we got, German Shepherd pointer. We brought him home. He was a 9-week-old pup, and we pulled a little quail out and put it on a string and put it in the bushes. And my wife was sort of standing off with a string attached to the bird, and we let the little pup run in front, and he pointed that thing at 9 weeks.
Wow.
And then he wanted to get it, so she lifted the bird up by the string, and he went running around, where'd it go? And he was turned on. So he was turned on to bird pointing from just a pup.
Isn't that funny? And you think, like, how does he know?
Yeah.
So how do you know if you're getting a dog that is going to be a good bird dog? I mean, is it a matter of the breeding? Is it a matter of the papers? I mean, what are the indicators that tell you?
Well, a lot of times you want to look for a breeder that's a reputable breeder. Mm-hmm. And one way we learn is we see people that get dogs from this particular breeder and we watch them. So you can learn a lot by just watching the behavior of certain dogs. Make sure you get a dog that, you know, has the demeanor and the behavior that you would like to have. A lot of them have adult dogs that have passed various tests, AKC Hunter tests or the North American Versatile Hunting Dog tests. Like we want a prize one dog, some dogs that show a high level of capability. Mm-hmm. And so if your dog comes from parents that did well in a testing situation, they're probably going to be a good hunting dog as
right.
well.
I'm guessing that these dogs are probably quite expensive, the high quality hunting dogs.
Yeah. I mean, they're running upwards of $2,000 a pup. Just yeah. for a little pup now.
And this is a dog that hasn't been trained yet. It's a
right.
blank slate.
Yeah. It's just the pup.
Yeah. Wow.
And 1,200, 1,000 to 2,000 is kind of the normal range now for a really good hunting dog.
Anybody who said hunting was an inexpensive hobby was definitely not on the mark.
Right.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about training dogs on today's show. And right now we're talking about training bird dogs, your partner when you're in the field hunting. And my guests are Bud Rice and Gretchen Clark, who are both involved with the Arctic Bird Dog Association, and Bud's also involved with the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association. So let's get down to the training practices and how you create a successful bird dog. Maybe I'll start with you, Gretchen, since you're kind of new to this, and it sounds like you had to kind of learn some of these skills in order to be successful. What's sort of step one with a puppy?
My first step was to take a puppy class, which mm-hmm. was essentially training me. It definitely wasn't training the dog. It was me learning different commands and how to handle a dog. Mm-hmm. So that was a 6-week program, and it's not specific to hunting dogs. It was open to any dog, so any pet owner should go to those courses. Mm-hmm. It helps establish fundamentals for your dog's behaviors.
You're consist just the same as you need if you're going to have a pet at home and you don't want it to ruin the furniture.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yep.
But then you're moving forward into some pretty specialized techniques and getting the dog to be able to work with you. How do you do that?
So I attended one of the novice flushing courses that the Bird Dog Association offered, which was introducing me to the different skills of a flushing dog. So I didn't have the experience with what the different characteristics were that were the norm or the expected behaviors for working in the field. So again, it was part training me and part training the dog. But we worked in the field, we worked on different drills, and introduced each different step at each week's course where you could see other dogs performing, other handlers, and how they were working with their dogs, and just different methods or different approaches to work with the dogs.
Mm-hmm. Now, with a flushing dog, it seemed like maybe it would have to be, discipline would not be quite as important as with a pointer, because you actually want the dog to be running around. Is that true?
Yes and no. You want the dog to be running back and forth so that they're working the field, but you do want to be able to have the control so that you can stop them if you need them to. Mm-hmm. You don't want them to get too far out, because if they flush a bird and they're out of your range, you're not going to be able to take a shot.
That's going to be reducing your chances rather
exactly.
than increasing them. Yeah.
So you do have to work with them and make sure that they're listening to the commands. And with my dog, I've worked really hard to have him trained with both voice commands, whistle commands, and I also train him with hand signals so that I don't have to yell, I don't have to be loud working with the dog. I can just point in a direction or, you know, use a different hand signal or a whistle call for the commands.
Mm-hmm. And you just have the one dog?
I do. He's my first dog.
Yeah. And I imagine that really would enhance your relationship with your dog, that the fact that you're learning to do some serious tasks together, some work together, rather than just jump in your lap or whatever.
I think so. It's really a partnership when you're working with the dog. You have to watch what they're doing, and they have to watch what you're doing. So you really do work as a team.
Mm-hmm. So, Bud, you work with pointers, and as we explained before, the pointer is going to go out and sort of let you know where the game is, but then also be very quiet so as not to scare the game away, which seems like a complicated behavior and one that's, to some extent, is maybe against the preference of the dog, because you know, you'd think that the dog would really want to go after it. What's this? What are the steps to training a pointer?
Well, a lot of times well, the first thing in training any dog is you get obedience.
Right.
And so you want to be able to stop the dog, whatever the command is, whoa, stop, you know, something like that. And I know that in flushers, they'll use the term hup for the dog to sit and just sit and stop and watch the trainer, then they'll wait for the next direction. We generally use whoa, and the dog's supposed to freeze. And it's a safety thing, too. If you cross the road and there's traffic coming, you want the dog to stop, not run out in front and get hit or something. So whoa is important. Stopping the dog somehow, and also to come to you, you know, like here or come or whatever the command is, a recall. Mm-hmm. So those are really important obedience things. Now, for training a dog on birds, a lot of times we'll use pigeons, and they're homing pigeons, and they're reusable birds, and so you'll have the dog find a pigeon on the ground, it might be in a lunch or whatever, and we'll release the bird. So you train the dog, if they get too close, you pop the bird and let it go home. And so they realize.
So the bird is sort of is like attached to something.
Yeah.
I see.
They can't get too close. Or we'll put a card on it and it'll fly a little bit. And the other thing we do with pointing dogs early on is we'll have them on a long line, a lead line, and have them do a pattern. Probably the flusher people do the same thing.
Yep.
And get a pattern in front of you. And then with pointing dogs, they can enlarge that pattern, you know, depending on the terrain that you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So we use long lines. And you can whoa them and stop it, you know, grab the line and stop the dog if you have to. So early on, you got to get control of the dog. And one way you get the way you control the dog is you control the dog's mind. If you can control their mind, then you've got the dog. So that's a key lesson we learned from a trainer down in Missouri, John Han. He says, you know, control the dog's mind, you control the dog.
But what does that mean? I mean, you're not using ESP, right?
Yeah. Well, there's different ways to do it. I mean, with the lead. Early on. And then another thing you can do is you can use what's called luring. So there's positive enforcement and negative reinforcement on dog behavior. And so like rewarding the dog with a piece of meat or a hot dog or a little tidbit of chicken or a biscuit or something, they'll say, well, I'm going to do that again because I got a reward. So like for healing, you can hold the thing between thumb and forefinger and have the dog right at your side and they're sticking their nose in your hand. You don't give it to them until they do that for a little bit. And then you say yes and you give them, you know, the reward, the lure. Mm-hmm. So that's a positive way. Negative reinforcement is through electronic collars, which is like a long lead, and it reaches out for, you know, a mile maybe, depending on your electronics. We use that. It's called stimulation, and you can test it on your wrist. We use the lowest level of stimulation you need to get the dog's attention.
Right.
Just to get his, pay attention.
And sometimes with the e-collar as well, you can use just a tone signal as opposed to using a shock.
Yeah. Well, once the dog's used to what that means.
Yeah. And we use whistling and stuff too to just get the dog to turn. A lot of times we'll just call the dog's name to get its attention. You don't want to just say, you know, hey dog, there may be more than one dog in the field. So use that dog's name to get that dog's attention. So that's one thing for.
So how many dogs do you have, bud?
We just have two, but we've had as many as 12. But that's when we're into racing, sprint racing,
I see.
Feature racing.
Yeah. So when you are hunting, would you have both dogs in the field at once?
Yeah, we can run both or one, either way. The nice thing about two dogs is that they'll cover more terrain, but we also train them to honor each other. So if one dog goes and punt, and the other dog sees that dog and point, they freeze. They may not detect the birds, but they're not supposed to go farther in because they might bust the covey out. So
what that makes me realize that these are complex behaviors.
Yes.
And when I think about how would I tell a dog that that's what I want him to do, I'm at a loss, right? How do you like, for example, that behavior you just mentioned of honoring the other pointer when he's pointing, how do you train him to do that?
Well, if you got the whoa command and they run along, they see the other bird and you've taught them that basic obedience, when they see that other dog, and you yell, whoa, they're supposed to stop. You really, I got to stop now.
Yeah.
And you might give it a reward or something like that. But it's repetitive. And a lot of this training is in baby steps. You don't go to full retrieve to hand right off the bat. You know, it takes a lot of little steps reinforcing, you know. Give the thing a bumper at first and then a frozen bird and then a soft bird, you know, in the mouth. Try to teach them not to crunch. Sometimes we'll use a plastic water bottle. So if they crunch it, you know, they're crunching. It'll crinkle and make sounds. So you don't want that. So it's a lot of little steps.
Well, it takes a great deal of patience, isn't it, Gretchen? I mean, this is sort of something where the personality of the bird dog hunter has got to be a little bit different from some other hunters who were looking for immediate gratification. Because if you don't do these habitual behaviors over and over again exactly the same way, it's just not going to work.
No, it's not. And I would say every time I go out and train with my dog, I'm learning something new, or he's learning something new, or we're working on a specific piece of the entire training package. And getting pointers from other people, you may be trying to get the dog to do one specific task and you're trying the same thing, and someone else is able to give you a suggestion just because they're the outside source looking at what you're doing, and they may have some critiques. So doing some of the group trainings is really, really beneficial to help support you mm-hmm. and get you in the right direction. It does take a lot of repetition. I would say every day I'm out with the dog in the backyard, in a field, wherever I take him, and we work on specific things. So we always do some of the retrieves. We'll do a marked retrieve, which is making him watch where you're throwing, whatever you're throwing, and then going to retrieve it and bring it back to you. But working on some tasks every single day to make sure that you're consistent and improving right. and maintaining the level that you've gotten. I don't want to spend time over the winter having, you know, a couch dog and then hit spring and run into problems that I have to correct where I could have maintained it all winter.
Forgot what he's like, a kid who's been on summer vacation. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, it sounds like something that is for people who have enough time to take on a hobby where they're going to spend time with their dog every day, you know, because it wouldn't be fair to the dog if you really don't spend that time and then you go out and inspect them to be ready to hunt.
You don't have to spend a lot of time each day. Sometimes mm-hmm. just a 10 or 15 minute session is all you need to just kind of keep their brain active and mm-hmm. realize what they're working towards. So,
which is probably what a dog should get anyway, right? Yeah. Every dog needs to have some mental stimulation.
Yep. Yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about bird dogs for upland hunting with two dog owners and trainers. At least, I guess, if you've got one of these dogs, that makes you a trainer. Bud Rice and Gretchen Clark. And my name is Charles Woolforth. So it sounds like one of the pleasures of this is a community that you are a part of, because this is really kind of a group activity that takes people, equipment, knowledge to do it. I know there must be just sort of the different relationship you have with your dog, and then also how it alters the hunting experience. And I mean, maybe I'll start with you, Bud. What is it about this that has, obviously for a very long time, has sort of kept you going and made you want to do it? What's sort of the pleasure, the love of it?
Yeah, I enjoy watching the dogs work in the field and using, you know, their athletic capability and their nose in particular. And they just sense things in the environment that we miss. And their nose is lower to the ground, and it's way more sensitive than the human nose, and you know, almost as sensitive as a bear nose. I mean, they really know what's going on in the environment, mm-hmm. and you can see them stop and investigate things. So a lot of times when they stop and investigate things and they move on, I go look and see what were they looking at. And sometimes you see a little bit of scat from a bird or something else, or some other animal. So they're picking up all this stuff, and they can sense it from, you know, some distance. And then when it comes to the hunting part, it's really a great, you know, team effort. And, you know, we train our dogs to point a bird, then we shoot them if we're lucky enough to get them, and then they retrieve them and bring them back. So, and a lot of times, in some case, like for ptarmigan, you shoot a ptarmigan and it falls into the willows. It's like, I'd never find that bird.
Yeah.
You send the dog in there and they snuffle it around and they find it quickly mm-hmm. and bring it out to you. So
it must really enhance your rate of success greatly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And also gives you a buddy to be doing it with, right?
Yeah, it's really fun.
Yeah.
Really fun.
Gretchen, let me ask you the same question. What is about this has made you really want to do it?
I grew up hunting with my dad, and I wanted to continue to do that. And having a dog is my partner in the field, where normally I would go out with my dad, and that was the team. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have a support so that I could be comfortable in the field if I wanted to go alone as well, and know that I had that teamwork and someone to help me retrieve the birds.
Uh-huh. So you sort of have a hunting partner, a built-in hunting partner.
I do.
Yeah. And how about this community aspect of it? Has that been something where you sort of get a built-in group of people who have the same interest and all that?
Absolutely. The group is fantastic. Any of the events, there's always food, always lots of food, and lots of game, which is great.
Yeah. I'm sure you guys have more game than you know what to do with, probably.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
But it's a great community, and they're really supportive and helpful, and they like to ensure that you're getting out and using your dog for the purposes that you're training them for.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like from the point of view of someone who is a hunter and wants to sort of take it to the next level and get into hunting with a dog, really step one is not going out and getting a dog. Step one is going to a club meeting and meeting other people who are doing it.
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah, you want to, if you think of that ahead of time, get with people that have been doing the activity and find somebody who's doing the activity you think you want to do, and then think about getting a dog and then training it. And then training yourself as well. And, you know, one of the other important aspects is safety mm-hmm. and hunting with dogs, and make sure that any shot you take is in a safe direction. There isn't a dog or another person in that direction. So, I mean, I really like wearing blaze orange, especially a hat and a vest or a shirt with, you know, some bright colors. And everybody in your party should do the same. And just make sure you're safe.
Yeah, yeah. So do you welcome members of the public to come to your meetings and sort of get a feel for this and meet some people who are into it?
Yeah, the Arctic Bird Dog Association has quarterly meetings. Now we have them at Cabela's in a conference room they have. We used to have them in, you know, cars, grocery stores, uh-huh. upstairs, but, you know, wherever we could get a free room. But that's kind of a nice location. And we bring in special speakers that talk about, you know, some aspect of training dogs or veterinary services, you know, how to treat your dog in the field if there's an injury of some sort, how to shoot, how to reload. I mean, it's a whole suite of interesting speakers. We get Rick Marazon, the small game biologist with the state, and he'll talk about, you know, the various surveys and research he's done. And we actually now are working with Fish and Game. We'll send pointing dogs out and do surveys, brood surveys of birds in the field, so we get an idea of how the reproductive level is going. So it goes on and on and on. It's really kind of a fun way to use your dogs and help the community.
Once you're into it, then it seems like it branches out in all directions. Just having the proviso that it's not necessarily easy. I mean, but nothing, you know, that's worth it really is easy. But I mean, it's a challenging thing, isn't it, Gretchen?
It is, and one of the things that I did before I even got a dog, I think I thought about it for 2 years, mm-hmm. and I did a lot of research to decide, is it the right time for me to get a dog? Is this the right kind of dog? What kind of hunting do I want to do? You know, what are my limitations? I don't really want to do waterfowl. It's too cold for me to go hunting in the wet conditions in late September. So that was part of my consideration when I was looking at which dog was going to be the right dog for me.
And you're living in Alaska. There couldn't be a better place for it, right? I mean, there's so many places for you to go hunting with your dogs.
It's great.
There are.
And we actually travel with our dogs and go outside as well. We go to Canada. We'll go to 48 states. We go down to have a relative in Georgia. We hunt bobwhite quail with them down there. And we hunt all manner of upland species of birds.
Yeah. So I just find this fascinating, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are really interested. We'll make sure that we have those websites links at outdoorexplorer.org, so you can find out about the clubs that my guests are members of. If you want to learn about training your own hunting dogs, getting a hunting dog, training them, and it sounds like they'd be happy to help. Well, thanks both of you for coming in today. It's been really interesting.
Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Having us.
Thanks, Bud and Gretchen. Bud Rice and Gretchen Clark. Bud is into pointing dogs. Gretchen's into flushing dogs. They're both involved in the Arctic Bird Dog Association, and Bud's also involved with the North American Versatile Hunting Dog Association. My name is Charles Wolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and with me now is a musher with 30 years of experience who started mushing in Europe, went to the Midwest, ended up here in Alaska, and has been mushing in Alaska for 17 years. The topic that I wanted to get into is how you create a dog team, especially the training aspect of it. I know I could certainly use some training help with my little dog. The dog seems to run the house the other way around. And mushers take dogs and train them to be members of teams that really perform at a high level and do what they're supposed to do. So how does that happen? And to talk about that, I've got Kourosh Partow, who is in the construction industry, but he's a musher, a competitive musher, and has been at it, as I said, for a long time. Thanks so much for being with us, Kourosh.
Thank you so much, Charles. I appreciate it.
So I just to begin with, I want to get into the training topic, which is our main topic today. But you started mushing in Europe rather than we think of sort of the Alaska sort of bush example as being the beginning and end of mushing, but it's not. Mushing is a worldwide sport, I guess.
It is correct, actually. We have a kind of a crazy story about our background in mushing. We lived actually in Paris and downtown, and we started with one and two Siberian Huskies in 1987, and living in a flat in Paris, and got into reading about sled dogs and training sled dogs, and decided to training them and exercising them. And it was actually in the streets of Paris with a bicycle being pulled.
That's
by
crazy.
Dogs.
That's about the last place I would expect a musher to come from. I mean, it just seems like everything about it is the polar opposite.
Yeah, it was actually, we had up to five dogs in Paris, and before we decided to move out to the countryside and establish a small kennel outside of Paris still, and followed the dry land and sled circuits throughout the Alps in Europe, and also in the Pyrenees in Spain.
Huh. So what was it that made you want to be a musher to begin with, rather than, you know, what people in Paris would normally be doing?
It's just the passion for the animals and the outdoors, quite honestly, for me. It's just being outside with, you know, your athletes, your sled dog companions, and just enjoying sometimes the freedom and the quiet and the loneliness that you experience when you are with your dogs.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed as I've traveled in Europe that the romance of the Alaska outdoors is something that's very much has a lot of power in those in the cultures there. Even though people may not know much about it, people do dream of the North.
Oh, absolutely. As a child, it may be a cliche comment, but we read Jack London books and talk about Alaska, and actually the Great North in general, and this is a myth almost in Europe. You know, snow, outdoors, big woods, rivers, mountains, and so. Even though in Paris we don't experience that, thanks to the books and media, we know about it, of course. And it's a bug. I always say that when you get it, you can't get rid of it anymore, and it becomes a lifestyle. And you spend hours and hours and years developing your techniques and your love for your sport.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine you had many people there to teach you to train sled dogs. Well, how did you develop your dog training techniques to build a team?
Actually, believe it or not, there are two or three sled dog clubs in Paris and around Paris area in France. And so what we did, we joined actually one of those clubs and kind of found ourselves mentors, asking him questions and trial and error, of course, too. And as you can imagine, around the the Paris and Région Parisienne area, we didn't have lots of snow, and so a lot of our training and learning was on bicycles and running behind the dogs and basically teaching them at the same time that dogs are teaching you what you have to do. And then the weekends, during the winter time, we used to go in the Alps and in the Pyrenees and in the Jura region and Switzerland, Italy, to race them with a sled.
So what are the key things that, you had to learn to create sled dogs out of just, you know, a puppy who has come on the scene? How do you, what are the initial stages and what are the key things that you need to know to train a dog?
You know, discipline is very important, and the fact of continuing the same pattern for the dogs and same routine day after day and year after year and month after year, month. Dogs are animals, and they don't know anything, so you have to teach them. Everything you do, they look and they learn. And if they have bad habits, it's your fault. It's not the dog's fault. And dogs are not born with experience and with techniques and with knowledge. Some of it, of course, is desire and it's in the breeding. But lots of it is things that they will learn as a puppy, how they are socialized, how they are behaving, what they are allowed to do and not to do. And as a matter of fact, the reason we start to exercise our dogs in the very, very first place is because we had a puppy and the puppy was destructive, like literally just destroyed the apartment. And then that's how we started to learn a little bit about canine behavior and what to do, how to exercise them, how to discipline them, yes, no, to be able to maintain this relationship with our pet.
Yeah. Do you subscribe to this the view that you're taking sort of the alpha role in the sort of the pack with your dog and trying to make the dog realize that sort of you're in charge in that instinctual way? Or is that... Do you subscribe to that kind of philosophy?
Yes and no, Charles. Yes, if you have a larger kennel and a bigger number of animals, yes, you have to establish some type of discipline. Who is in charge to avoid any type of aggressivity and problems among the males or the females or any challenges between the dogs? We have actually a park in the property here, and the dogs are in the park, and we have 16 sled dogs here, and they're all together. We don't have challenges. They don't challenge each other, so there's not a leader of the pack and the bottom of the, you know, the totem pole. Everybody is equal, and each one of them, they know their position in the team.
Mm-hmm. And that's something you establish.
Yeah. So it is important. I've seen some people making the mistake to separate them all the time, and they have to worry about aggressive dogs among themselves. And that's a big challenge because you know, our sports, in our sports, we have a lot of kids, juniors involved also. And we don't allow that dogs to be aggressive toward each other or toward human beings.
Just in terms of the safety factor, yeah. We're talking about dog mushing today and dog training. And right now I have Kourosh Partow, who's coming to us from Chugiak, and he's been a musher for many years and has a team. And is a very, very active racer and has been for 4 decades. And my name is Charles Woolforth. So do you, when you say you have a park, does that mean you don't use tethers? I mean, this has been a very controversial aspect of
of dog mushing. The fact that, you know, dogs spend so much time on tethers and are separated and makes it imagery which is difficult to explain and is potentially damaging to the sport. Do you keep them on tethers most of the time, or is that something that you're getting beyond?
No, they're on tether most of the time, and they have their free time when I'm there and they're supervised. I personally don't feel comfortable leaving them, all 16 of them, running around loose by themselves without supervision. You never know mm-hmm. what's going to happen, and I don't want to have any challenges in general. But our area is the park, which I called it. So the dogs are tethered within the park area, and they get loose and they exercise in the park. And of course, as soon as the weather cools down, like now, we start to train four times a week, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, religiously. And so they get all the free time that they want in the woods, at the beach lake trails where we train. And there are designated mushing trails.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they can run and play. And usually after we train, we have another session of just playing in the park, and they horseplay and play around and just being dogs.
Right, right. So they have a pretty good life. So let's get back to the, you know, when you start out with a puppy and when you're creating a sled dog, how are you communicating to them what they're supposed to be doing? I mean, as you said, they have to learn everything, but how do they learn?
Majority of the sled dogs, and I say majority of them, they have this desire and have this gene of being a working dog. And so I would say 90-95% of them, they start as a sled dog. So because they've been bred for generations after generations after generations to be working dogs and to pull. So usually we have usually around two puppies a year. And of course the pups are they are not tethered. They're, you know, they're in the park in a kennel area. And as they grow, they become part of the pack, basically. So they run around the adults, and, you know, they learn they have to respect the adults, and they have to respect each other, and they have to do this and that. Around 8 months or so, we start leash training them. So basically, they walk around with a leash, and so they can understand control, being controlled. So they're not, you know, running around without being controlled by a line or something holding them. After that, usually that is for a couple of weeks, and after that, we train them with a harness, just pulling us. Actually, just jogging behind them or just walking behind them, and they are going forward with the forward motion. I always call that when people are asking me how to start sled dogs, they have to have forward motion. They have to go forward, and that's how they learn to pull. And when they establish this this attitude of moving forward, at that point we incorporate them in the adult team, usually a smaller team, five, six dogs, and we put them right in the middle among the adults, experienced dogs, make sure that dogs next to them are not too hyper. And then we just establish this this desire to pull and work on it. And, of course, in the beginning, they are not very familiar with commands or different techniques or lines, you know, how to run on the right side or left side, how to untangle themselves if they go under the line. And as they grow and as they become more and more exercised, they develop those techniques.
Are they learning those kind of from the team and from from the other dogs as much as they are from you?
Yes, trial and error sometimes. Again, they're intelligent animals, but they have to learn still, and sometimes they make mistakes. We are working with pups right now, and you know, the first training, as you know, they're attached by the tug line, what we call them, the tail line, basically, to the harness, and the neck line, which is to the collar. So two point of attachment, and normally in a well-disciplined sled dog team, each dog minds its own business and on each side and doesn't bother the neighbor, and as they're running tandem in a race. And puppies, they don't know. They go and under the line and they'll play with the dogs next to them, or try to, you know, be puppies, you know, just jump on their face and play. And usually the adult next to them, they know better and they don't pay attention and just continue. And the puppies, after after a few trainings, they learn that you know, nobody's going to play with them next to them. So that's always better if you have an adult kind of teach the younger dog to establish some of the ground rules in a team. And as they as I mentioned in the beginning, training and being consistent in your training is extremely important. So they will learn that every Tuesday, every Thursday, every Sunday, Saturday, they have to do the same thing, and you reinforce some of their desires and some of the techniques again and again and again and again and again, and then it becomes Bible for them, and they know that they have to do this. They know that this is allowed, this is what we want, and this is not allowed, for example. And usually after they are a year old, they are completely well-established sled dog and ready to go. And
that's so interesting about the consistency and having habit and sort of doing things the same way. I mean, that's something that people often have a problem with. And I suppose if you're the sort of person who has trouble keeping very regular habits, you may not be very good at training dogs.
Yes, absolutely. Because as I mentioned, some of the natural desires they have, and some of the rest of them, the discipline has to be taught. And you cannot ask them to, run on the right side of the line and 2 days later on the left side of the line, and now you're going to do this and that. You have to be consistent as long as you know what you are doing. And for us, it took years to establish some of the training techniques that we have. You know, I often go to training areas and I see some newer or more experienced people. They have different techniques, may work or may not work for them. This is the system which works for us. Consistency is super, super important.
Yeah. Kuraj Partow is with me. He's a musher based in Chugiak, who started mushing in Paris, of all places, and now has been in Alaska for many years as a competitive musher. We're talking about training sled dogs on today's show about dog training. My name is Charles Wolforth. It's Outdoor Explorer. So just to bring this to something that would be applicable to a person at home with their pet, when you talk about discipline and sort of imposing your will or communicating your will to a dog, how is that communicated exactly? Can you do it just with a stern voice? I've heard some people say only positive conditioning is valid. What is your technique of actually communicating to this dog what they're not supposed to do?
Positive, yes. Positive training is important. At the same time, you have to have some type of discipline. As a puppy, for example, we don't allow them to jump in your face and when you're standing next to them. So it, just a tap on their nose, it teaches them. And that's the time that you need to teach them when they're younger, so you don't have to worry about it when they are adults, powerful animals, and, you know, 60 pounds of muscle is jumping in your face or attacking another dog, for example. A lot of those positive trainings are established when they're younger dogs. And just the no is sometimes a very, very strong response that they can get from you. When the dogs are lead dogs, for example, just maybe they are making a mistake in the directions, for example, in a sprint team. As you know, we say G and haw for right and left. And if they have a younger dog next to them and try to teach the younger dog to become a leader and they make a mistake in the direction, and they know immediately they did something wrong and they change direction. So I agree with you. It has to be taught as in a very, very young age and then developed further and further and further to make him a sled dog.
Yeah, and there has to be some discipline at the beginning for them to learn the meaning of no and for that to be kind of really programmed into the dog at a very young age.
Yeah, as I said, it's just a simple, you know, flinging a nose when they are jumping or biting your hands when they're puppies. It's all they need. You don't need to beat them with a shovel or something like that.
Right.
I mean, they're young animals, it's important to teach them good and bad from the beginning. As I mentioned, a lot of our dogs have the hunting dog mixture and background, and those dogs are extremely sensitive. So they are getting further and further from the old Alaskan husky sled dogs that we had in Alaska 50 or 60 years ago, which were more independent animals. And, you know, they used to freight and they used to be basically born and raised as sled dogs. These dogs, these new generations of the dogs that we have, mixture of Alaskan Huskies and German Shorthair Pointers and English Pointers, are very, very attached to their owners and companions. And I always joke about it because when I yell at them, sometimes I say, "Oh, I hurt their feelings," because they have feelings. You can see they're pouting because they got in trouble. And so this positive training, as you're mentioning, is important and is way easier, in my opinion, with this new generation of sprint sled dogs that we have currently in Alaska, actually in the world, and the old style, more of a primitive sled dogs that we had, 60, 70, 100 years ago.
What makes these breeds better? Is it because they're more agile and less just built of muscle? Because I guess those old, traditional Alaska Husky was built not for racing, but for, you know, pulling a lot of cargo and having a lot of endurance. Or is there something different about these dogs that makes them better for sprint mushing?
Oh, by far, absolutely. Actually, we were one of the very, very first people in the United States importing hunting dogs, which were actually bred to be sled dogs from Europe. As our sport is growing and developing, the dogs are becoming more and more specialized overall. And the freight dogs and the dogs with longer hair and with a more compact body, they were not performing as well as some of the European dogs we had at one point. Because in Europe, especially in Northern Europe, Scandinavia, for years and years, people in Norway, Sweden, Finland, they've been using bird dogs, hunting dogs, actually, to ski jor, to do polka other activities. So the dogs are pets, actually. So they lived in the house, and during the fall, they were bird hunting with them. And later in the winter, they were pulling a child with a ski or a little kick sled. So for generations, hundreds of years probably.
They were learning to do it, yeah.
Exactly. So as the sprint sport got bigger and bigger, the desire for speed got more aggressive. And so we start to work on hybrid vigor, which means introducing new blood into the sled dog, the common sled dog, which completely changed the nature of our sport. And currently, you very, very, very seldom see competitive sprint teams without some type of bird dog and hunting dog blood in them. And that's what we did. Mm-hmm. We imported, I believe, 10 hunting dog mix or purebred from Norway. And
are they more intelligent as well?
Well, they are. As I mentioned, the typical sled dog, Alaskan Husky, is a very, very independent animal. Mm-hmm. They are survivors. They know how to survive eating salmon.
Whatever's out there.
In the village, exactly. On the other hand, the high maintenance, the English pointers and German shorters or mixes, they are usually pets. And they are very, very attached to you, very attached to you. Their training is completely different. They're hard keepers because they don't have a lot of hair. So my houses, for example, here, they are completely insulated. They have heat pads in them. They have doors in them. If some of my dogs, I put them in, I don't know, in Kotzebue, in that type of environment, they don't last. They are like a Formula One. They're like a NASCAR. And they are high maintenance, but they go extremely fast. So you have to pay for the speed, more work, more maintenance, more personal relationship with these dogs. And you have to baby them, definitely. You have to baby them in trainings and in off time that you have.
Fascinating. Well, this is this time has gone by extremely fast. It's such a interesting topic, and so the European aspect of it is one that I find particularly interesting, and so we pursue that more in the future. My guest has been Kourosh Partow, who's a musher, has been mushing for some 30 years, started in Paris, has been here in Alaska for 17 years, and is very busy out on the competitive trail. Thanks so much for being with us, Kourosh.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Charles.
Well, that's all for today's show. I want to thank my earlier guests as well, Gretchen Clark and Bud Rice from the Arctic Bird Dog Association. Our producer for Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork, assistant producer Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.